Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach, and we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
Before we get started with this week's theme, we want to share some prison-related news.
Marissa Alexander is free. She had been sentenced to 20 years in prison for firing a warning shot at her abusive husband and had unsuccessfully defended her action as self-defense under Florida's Stand Your Ground law. She was also the victim of Florida's mandatory sentencing laws, which require many years in prison for people who fire warning shots. Alexander spent almost 3 years in prison and 2 years of confinement in her home, during which time she had to wear an ankle monitor. Alexander testified that her ex-husband threatened to kill her in August 2010, 9 days after she gave birth to their daughter. To prevent an attack, Alexander fired her legally registered gun into the ceiling. In sworn statements, her ex-husband admitted that he physically abused her. Alexander has established a nonprofit organization, the Marissa Alexander Justice Project, to offer advocacy in cases of domestic violence and to promote policy reform.
The mass incarceration of African Americans has contributed significantly to the racial achievement gap in the nation's schools, according to a recent report by the Economic Policy Institute. The so-called war on drugs vastly expanded the U.S. prison population. However, while African Americans are no more likely than whites to sell and use drugs, they are 3 times more likely to be arrested and more likely to be convicted and serve more time in prison than whites. According to the report, when a parent goes to prison, their children become more susceptible to depression, behavioral problems, and ADHD. The report says that their grade point average drops and they're more likely to drop out of school. Boys are more likely to drop out because they themselves have been incarcerated. The report urges educators to join with the criminal justice reformers to advocate for policies that would end mass incarceration. In Indiana, African Americans are about 10% of the population, but 40% of the inmates in prisons and jails.
According to AlterNet, people around the country are forming local people's movement assemblies, or PMAs, to empower and connect communities facing right-wing assaults. PMAs have played a crucial role in connecting currently and formerly incarcerated people with each other and movements on the outside. In 2011, in Montgomery, Alabama, the formerly incarcerated PMA took place. It was a gathering committed to sharing strategies challenging 3 key issues within the prison industrial complex: employment discrimination, shackling of women prisoners during labor, and voting disenfranchisement after serving prison sentences. People across Alabama are continuing to organize PMAs related to the criminal justice system and the drug war. Those assemblies are led by formerly and currently incarcerated people and their families and are held through conference calls and by going into prisons. The PMAs analyze problems and undertake actions, such as rallies, marches, or protests. Participants have protested outside of prisons and held marches and rallies in front of departments of correction.
Prisoners at Louisiana's infamous Angola prison have launched a new initiative called Decarcerate Louisiana. Ronald Brooks, one of the founders, explained that the group's goal is to unite prisoners and outside supporters for study circles and advocacy against mass incarceration. You can learn more at decarceratelouisiana.com.
According to the Department of Justice, almost 2/3 of the 500,000 U.S. inmates released from prison each year will face arrest again within 3 years. Former prisoners face problems including difficulty finding stable housing, insufficient access to drug and alcohol treatment, and lack of education and job training. 60 to 75% of former inmates have no job 1 year after their release. This problem is compounded for people of color. The National Institute of Justice found that African Americans with criminal records were refused jobs nearly twice as often as white applicants with such records. According to NPR News, another important problem former prisoners face is, quote, navigating a world that they've been secluded from for years or even decades, unquote. To complicate matters, 25 states, including Indiana, allow employers to ask job applicants initially about their criminal records and to perform a background check later in the employment process.
Jason Robb and Sadiq Abdul Hassan began refusing food on Monday, February 27th, to protest a 90-day restriction on their access to phone, email, and video visit communication. Ohio State Penitentiary issued this restriction to prevent them from pleading their innocence publicly. Both Hassan and Robb appeared on video in a recent episode of the Netflix documentary series Captives. The Captives documentary told the story of the Lucasville uprising and hostage situation. The filmmakers intended an unbiased 360-degree view of the uprising and hostage situation, but their final product consisted almost entirely of interviews with the then-warden, Arthur Tate, multiple guards, and state-cooperating prisoners. It gave far more screen time to the state side of the story, yet the inconsistencies of the state's account of its conduct during the uprising became abundantly clear even from their own words. Only short portions of Hassan and Robb's interviews were included in the documentary. Regardless, though the Ohio prison system is currently punishing and censoring them, because its position on the uprising and on their guilt depends greatly on restricting their speech and controlling the narrative. Hassan and Robb are two of many plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections for restricting media requests to uprising prisoners. Specifically, Hassan and Robb are the only two contesting the absence of due process in the punishments they have received, since they proudly acknowledge giving the interviews. They are two of the five prisoners who have been condemned to death and held in solitary confinement since the uprising in 1993. The actual participation of four of the Lucasville Five in the uprising was to negotiate a peaceful surrender and prevent greater loss of life. Bomani Shakur, the fifth defendant, was arrested at the very beginning of the uprising and did not participate at all. The ODRC and State of Ohio promised not to go after specific individuals in the negotiation of that surrender, and then immediately targeted the negotiators, painting them as leaders and orchestrators of a spontaneous riot that, without their intervention and cooperation across race and gang lines, could have easily become bloodier. If you want to call in and support Hassan and Robb's hunger strike, you may contact Warden Ed Sheldon and demand that he rescind communication restriction for Jason Robb and Sadiq Abdullah Hassan. The phone number is 330-743-0700. Fax 330-743-0841. Or you can email drc.osp@odrc.state.oh.us. Their address is 878 Coitsville Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. We'll have more of that information on our website as well. Since Sadiq Hassan is currently unable to give phone interviews, we are sharing an audio statement he made 4 years ago at the beginning of another hunger strike he waged for his right to communicate. The rights that he and other prisoners from the Lucasville uprising do have to communicate have been won through various struggles like the one going on now. The situation is serious, though, as Hassan approaches his third full week without food.
This is Imam Sadiq Abdullah Hassan calling from Ohio State Penitentiary, Supermax Prison in Youngstown, Ohio. As of today, April 11th, 2013, myself and three other prisoners who was convicted as a result of the Lucasville disturbance, we started a hunger strike. The purpose for this hunger strike is the fact that the prison authority all the way up to central office have been denying us access to the media. And this has been going on for 20 years. Initially, what the prison officials was telling those who have sent in requests to meet with us was that they could not meet with us because it posed a threat to security of institutions. And this consists of people from like the New York Times, 48 Hours, Vibe Magazine, and several others. After that, when we went to trial and we were erroneously convicted, the prison director, the chief, Reginald Wilkerson, he stated to a reporter from the Columbus Dispatch that anyone who was convicted as a result of the Lucasville disturbance would not be allowed to meet with the media.
Call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded.
When other prisoners on death row and other prisoners confined here at the Ohio State Penitentiary have been allowed to have access to meet with the media, and we're being denied just because the state don't want us to speak about our criminal case. We feel that that's unjustifiable. It's unjust. We do have a constitutional violation here where we're being denied an equal treatment up under the law. And basically what is happening, because the court allows the prison authority to have a broad range of discretion with regards to security issues, the institutions throughout the state of Ohio have taken advantage of that and not grant us the opportunity to meet with the media. The reason that the state has been successful in allowing this to happen is because the media itself has not been vigorously challenged in this particular issue. Not only just the media, but human rights organizations have been not vigorously challenged in this. And we ask them that the media, as well as leading human rights groups, would take a firm stance with us and try to push the issue and being allowed to meet with us. One of the things that the prison officials have also tried to say is that they don't want us speaking about overcrowdedness. They don't want us speaking about our long-term confinement in Supermax prison, because we've been confined since the disturbance in 1993. And we would like to speak with the media, in particular, with regards to our cases. So again, our simple request at this point is for the media and leading human rights groups to push the issue, to get this out in the public, and the more people that will make requests to speak to us on camera, we think we have a better chance of succeeding in what we're trying to accomplish, and that is getting the truth out as to what happened during the Lucasville disturbance. And it's obvious that the prison officials does not want it to be known to the public what happened. The state does not wish for us to speak about what actually happened during the Lucasville disturbance. So we're calling on the public to get involved, to make requests to meet with us, and push the issue, and God willing, we'll be allowed to meet with the media. I can assure you, what we have to say will be very interesting to the media.
You have 60 seconds left on this call.
We missed two meals already. About 6:15, we were through a child, and by 11 o'clock this morning, they'd served lunch. And we'll be on for a while unless they are going to meet us and resolve our issue, because we only have one request, and that is the opportunity to meet with the media. Grant us the same opportunity that you grant other prisoners on death row and prisoners in general. All right, peace out. This is Imam Sadiq Abdullah Hassan from Ohio State Penitentiary in Youngstown, Ohio.
This episode completes our series on the mass escape from the Immigrant Detention Center in Woomera, Australia. Aaron Azura, a participant in the protest camp that facilitated the breakout, has already described the implementation of racial immigration codes and later of mandatory detention, the escalation of refugee protest, and the organizing of the camp. He then told the story of those fateful days around Easter 2002. Now he'll complete the account by describing the long aftermath, including the dystopian project undertaken by the Australian government to turn remote islands into total prisons for refugees fleeing civil war. But Aaron also emphasizes the work of both prisoners and outside supporters to cross even this incredible gap. Back to Aaron.
The following year, there was a protest at Baxter, which I didn't attend. And it was a great protest, but it was symbolic in the sense that it was impossible to get more closer than, I think, 1.5 kilometers to the detainees. And so they used a lot of visual and sound kind of, sound protest tactics like flares, like balloons, kites, et cetera, to tell the detainees that they were there, but there was not any possibility of getting very close to them. I want to talk now about what the state of mandatory detention is in Australia at the moment, and what recent government policy is, and also some of the campaigns that have responded to that. In the long term, for a very brief period, detention policy or asylum seeker policy in Australia improved under a Labor government that had campaigned on a more humanitarian policy. A lot of people were put on temporary visas, which meant that they were released from detention. It was understood as temporary, but those ended up being extended for a long time. But in the long term, I guess racist immigration politics have always been a kind of wedge in Australian politics, and the wedge kept on being inserted. A lot of that was influenced from the far right, on panic about asylum seekers and refugees and immigrants taking people's jobs, about the kind of queue jumper rhetoric again. The government kind of eased up on the people who were actually in detention, that began a policy of deterrence that was focused on having a much more militarized border patrol that basically tried to prevent boats from landing at all. At the same time as that, they came up with something called the Pacific Solution, which was that detention camps were moved from mainland Australia to very small islands in the Pacific, where, and Australia is, I guess it's kind of similar to the U.S. and Latin America in that there's a lot of Australian resources and aid going to various, very small Pacific countries. The Australian government was able to leverage that to get islands to agree to have camps be there. So there's a camp now that's been there for a very long time on Nauru, a very tiny island. There are camps in Papua New Guinea, and the idea was to basically move detention centers offshore so that they would be even more inaccessible and so that there would be even less oversight. And currently to even get to Nauru, you have to apply for a visa, which has to be approved by the federal government. They don't even approve journalist visas, let alone humanitarian visas. And detainees in those camps have continued to protest. And at the moment, the situation is actually worse than it's ever been, I think, because there's no clear... Basically, the current Australian government has said that no detainees will be resettled in Australia. So they're even trying to negotiate resettlement agreements with the U.S., which is why in January, and people might have seen that Donald Trump had a very negative phone conversation with the Australian Prime Minister. And I'm pretty sure that it was negative and that Trump hung up the phone because the Prime Minister had negotiated this resettlement policy with President Obama to resettle these detainees who'd been in indefinite detention on Nauru to the U.S. And obviously Trump is not going to do that because he's clamping down on immigration in the U.S. And the deterrence policy keeps on going, but because war has continued in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, Syria, there's a more massive refugee crisis than there was 10 years ago. Boats continue to try to land on Australian shores, and mostly they're picked up at sea, and people are shipped off to camps in the Pacific. At the moment, the coalition government in Australia is conducting refugee detention under policy called Operation Sovereign Borders. And it's led by the Australian Defence Force. It's militarized, and its aim is to stop boat arrivals of asylum seekers to Australia altogether. It also uses the previous Pacific Solution policies of moving camps entirely to small islands in the Pacific. So at the moment, camps are based on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea and Nauru, which is a very tiny island in the South Pacific. So it's really difficult to access asylum seekers or to talk to detainees or to visit them. It's really difficult to get a visa to Manus Island or Nauru. So that's made the project of supporting detainees really difficult. So there's a lot of support campaigns and campaigns that are responding to Operation Sovereign Borders, though one of them has been going for a long time, but it's become one of the leaders in terms of refugee and asylum seeker mobilizations on the left, and that is an organization called RISE, Refugees, Survivors, and Ex-Detainees. And it's an organization that supports detainees both in detention and out, and once they get out, or if people are out, that's run and governed by refugees and asylum seekers and ex-detainees. So their slogan is "Nothing About Us Without Us." And they do a lot of campaigning on the basis of not having people speak for detainees or asylum seekers, but actually actively taking part in kind of campaigns and trying to figure out policies themselves. And they have a huge amount of services. They do advocacy, they have support services, they have a drop-in center. In fact, they started as a drop-in center, but they also do a whole lot of campaigning. And they're based in Melbourne. And then the other really exciting branch of campaigning that's happened in the last 5 years is an interest from people who have been involved in fighting detention for a very long time in detention supply chains, by which I mean the companies who actually manage detention centers, but then the whole chain of investment in those companies. So an organization called Ex-Border Operational Matters has been going for about the last 3 or 4 years now, and they do writing and research into detention supply chains. And then as a result of that research, there's a whole lot of people who have done different campaigns. A lot of them are aimed at Transfield, which is the company that currently manages the Australian government contracts to run detention centers. And Transfield is a huge company with lots of kind of offshoots that many Australian companies, in fact, globally, other corporations invest in. And in fact, one of the really successful campaigns has been for retirement funds to divest from investing in Transfield. And most retirement funds in Australia, or many of them, are actually run by unions or used to be publicly run, but have now are privatized, but they will match kind of, they run in concert with unions, which are still fairly important in Australian labor organizing. So there's been a lot of successful campaigns to get retirement funds to divest from Transfield. And the other, not necessarily successful, but very public way of drawing attention to Transfield's investment is to draw attention to the kind of board of directors of Transfield, get Transfield to also sponsor cultural events like the Sydney Biennale and a festival called the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. So there have been some successful campaigns to get artists and cultural speakers to boycott both the Biennale and the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, and to start talking about the way that the chain of kind of corporate investment actually makes many more people accountable for ongoing detention than you might actually think. So a couple of years ago, Pussy Riot were invited to the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, and there was a pretty big campaign to get them to boycott it. People don't always boycott, but sometimes they do, and this is obviously drawing a lot of inspiration and strategy from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in the U.S. and globally around Palestine. So that's a kind of summary of some of the things that are happening, as well as the ongoing project of supporting detainees who are in detention and responding to particular instances. For example, just in the past couple of days, there's been a report of sexual assault in a detention center. It's really unclear whether it's by a guard or who the perpetrator was, but a lot of the time when that happens, there are campaigns that are trying to get people who are in particular crisis out of detention and receive medical care on the mainland. And sometimes that's successful, sometimes it's not. Detainees have continued to protest on Manus Island and on Nauru. There is a continuing use of self-harm to protest, but also what is happening is that because, especially on Manus Island, which is within Papua New Guinea, it's very unclear sometimes who is actually running detention centers, and it's a combination of Transfield guards and local police or kind of local security. And a lot of the time there's huge pushback from the detainees towards these different overlapping security guard kind of things. So there have been huge protests. One of the protests happened in 2013, and it is understood in mainstream media as a riot, and a 23-year-old Iranian asylum seeker called Reza Barati was killed during that protest. So there's been, you know, there's been continuing desire to protest, to go on hunger strike, to use all the, you know, all the strategies that they have available, protesting by not refusing to leave the, by refusing to leave the compound, for example, or by trying to break out. Those protests, even though there's the detention centers are so distant from the Australian mainland now, there's still a lot of reports that get out. So one of the really important ways to support asylum seekers is to make sure asylum seekers and detainees have phones so that they can communicate with people on the outside, and that there's a, you know, there's an ongoing campaign to give people phone credit just so that they can actually communicate.
Thanks again to Aaron for speaking with us. This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512, or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on KiteLine at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.